I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Asar Nafisi. She's author of several books, including Reading Lolita in Tehran. Her new book is called The Republic of Imagination, America in Three Books. She's a fellow at the Foreign Policy Institute of Johns Hopkins University's School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, D.C. And tomorrow night, April 17th, she will be talking at St. John's College in the Great Hall of the Peterson Student Center. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here.
So you start the book, The Republic of Imagination, with a story of a young man whom you call Ramin. Mm-hmm. You met him in a bookstore. He was badly abused by the authorities in Iran. He was a great reader, and he didn't believe that Americans understood or cared about books, including their own, our own fiction, as much as many Iranians did, which is a fascinating proposition. What is the source of this attitude? How do people come to think this way? What do you think of it?
Well, you know, one of the most interesting things about this encounter with Ramin, which stayed in my mind, was, in fact, the power or the nature of literature and all products of imagination. The fact that once they are presented to the world, they belong not just to the place where they come from, but they sort of break all limitations and boundaries and become the property of those who care most about them. And I think that implied in what he was telling me, or maybe unconsciously what he was saying, was that they don't appreciate these books, but we do. So in a sense, then you possess what you appreciate and care about. And I found that both very poignant as well as very true.
Why do you think it is that, I mean, as you write about, under repressive regimes like Iran, like many others, the governments are so threatened by the arts and literature and the free exchange of ideas and books like the kind that you're talking about?
Well, that is one of the most amazing things about works of imagination, and especially books, because books are portable, and they're so easy to have and to read and to hide, in fact, and to have access to. But what I found amazing in Iran was the fact that once your spaces in reality are taken away from you, or once your means of public communication with the world is taken away from you, the only space you can really retreat to, and the only space that would connect you to both the fellow citizens in the country you live, as well as to the world, is through works of imagination and literature. And that is in itself threatening to the regime. And like here, where many of our elite believe that books are irrelevant, over there, books become dangerous because they are carriers of ideas. And ideas are the most dangerous thing to any repressive mindset. So usually, no matter where you go in the world, let's say in Germany during fascism, in Soviet Union and Eastern Europe during the Soviet rule, or in Iran under the Islamic regime, or in Saudi Arabia, all of them react to three targets. Their victims become, at the beginning of every rule, women, minorities, and culture in general, and works of imagination and ideas in particular. So repression is also universal, and its targets are universal.
It's so interesting because this whole dynamic is riddled with all kinds of paradoxes that you write about very eloquently in the book. And one of them is that, I mean, there you were living in Iran, and as you write, your views became more complex and nuanced living under repression. Then you came to the United States, which is a vast, complex, sprawling, multicultural society. And yet what you found when you began teaching in universities here was intellectual oversimplification and a lack of self-reflection. How do you understand this paradox?
Well, that also, usually, especially in the world today, where everything is so much politicized and polarized, simplifications of both reality and imagination and ideas have become almost the norm. And I think that that is what makes it all very dangerous, because in a country like America, and I mentioned it in the introduction to Republic of Imagination, and bring quotes deliberately from poets and writers who come from repressive societies like Eastern Europe, because they immediately understand that in a country like the United States, you are much freer. You have much more freedom of expression, freedom to write and to read and to associate. But at the same time, repressive methods are much more seductive and hidden. So you don't ban, of course, we do ban books, actually, as you know. We have banned from Huckleberry Finn and Great Gatsby to Toni Morrison's Beloved and other books. But rather than putting people in jail or torturing them, what we do, we kill the urge to be curious and to empathize and to rebel against repression through entertainment and through indifference. And I'm always reminded of Ray Bradbury, who used to say that you don't have to burn books as they do in fascist countries. You don't have to burn books to destroy a culture. All you have to do is to get people not to read.
Right.
And this is what I feel threatens United States and democratic societies, not obvious and naked brutality, but a different kind of brutality, which is indifference towards the best achievements of humanity or human history, which is in fact liberal arts, which is in fact works of imagination and ideas. We just ignore them and thereby, in a sense, kill them.
You would think that schools and universities would be kind of the last bastion or the safe refuge, but even those places are no longer really in this country safe for ideas and especially for works of fiction and imagination.
No, you're completely right, and that is what scares me so much, because in every single book I talk about in this recent book, every single one of them, what it targets as the main enemy in this country is complacency and conformism. And this feeling of complacency and conformism is the fact that we don't listen to anything but what we like to listen to, we don't read anything but what we like to read to, and we don't write anything but what we like to write about. And in our schools, we are, especially in our public schools, we are underfunding public schools. We are taking out music and art and poetry and fiction as things that are unnecessary to our lives. So we are creating a nation that cannot think. That is why I am getting more and more worried about our system of education and the way it is being sort of undermined and destroyed from within, on one hand by simplification of what we teach our students, and on the other hand by our promotion of merely success and wealth and dog-eat-dog world, a vision of a dog-eat-dog world where we only take into consideration our own selfish goals,
yes,
to what used to be very American, which was compassion and connection to the world and independent thinking. All of these are being undermined by this new culture, new view of looking at life.
You know, you write about that, and there's a quote that I wanted to read aloud, and you wrote, "If it's true that in a democracy, imagination and ideas are secondary, a kind of luxury," and by the way, you wrote about how it was, I can't remember what newspaper it was, but in one paper, the book review was relegated to the luxury section. I mean,
yeah,
literally.
Bloomberg News, yeah.
Okay. But anyway, if ideas and imagination are a sort of luxury, then what is the purpose of life in such a society? What will make its citizens loyal and concerned about their country's well-being? and not just their own selfish pursuits. And I think that brings up such an interesting question about the role of imagination and literary truth-telling in the maintenance of political democracy itself.
Oh, definitely. You know, one of the things that really worries me, and I know that we in the academia are also responsible for it, is the fact that we are thinking of imagination and ideas as a sort of luxury. Now, I remember that a long time ago, one of the members of Congress was talking about, you know, why do we need to fund the museums? Because and he claimed to be saying this on behalf of the common people. You know, and it really enraged me because I'm living in the nation's capital, and one of the best things about Washington is the Smithsonians. And Smithsonian, first of all, and like our policymakers, does not segregate between science and natural history and art and literature. They all come under human knowledge, necessary human knowledge. And the second thing about it is the fact that, you know, I go into these museums and they're all free. This is one thing our government has done for the people. And people who are there are not members of Congress or the most wealthy people in our country. And these museums are usually full. And they are full with ordinary, quote-unquote, common people who just love to come and browse through, get something about their own culture as well as other cultures. The same is true of programs like Kennedy Center has the millennial stage, where they perform music from America and all over the world for free. And there are huge lines for people going to and listening to free concerts, or Shakespeare in the Park in New York. These people forget that the art and storytelling was not a luxury to begin with. It was a way of surviving in this world. The Greek mythology, Roman mythology, even the stories in Bible and Torah and Quran, people found a way of understanding the world through articulating it through stories and through connecting to one another. And to make such audacious presumptions is really beyond the pale. And you have to ask them to really go and read the Founding Fathers. You know, they might learn something from them about this issue.
We're talking to author Asar Nafisi. The title of the latest book, The Republic of Imagination, is America in Three Books. And the three books you write about a lot of books, but the three main books are Huckleberry Finn by Mark Twain, Babbitt by Sinclair Lewis, and The Heart is a Lonely Hunter by Carson McCullers. But the way you write about them, which I loved, was not just about the books, but you also include a lot of stories about your own life and about the people whom you have loved and cared about and who have affected you and changed you. And it struck me that maybe what you're doing, or I wondered about this, is guiding the reader to think about the books that affect us and the people who affect us together, and about the ways that this understanding between books and people interact and really deepen each other.
You're exactly right. I'm so glad that you mentioned it, because I learned about this also when I went back to Iran, because until then, I had always read books. You know, there's this quotation from Scott in Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird, where she says, "Until I feared I would lose it, I never loved to read. One does not love reading." And that is how I felt. Books had always been with me. Stories had always been with me. So I never felt that there would come a time where I would actually have to think about what would my life be like without being able to read what I want, until I went back to Iran. And there I realized how life and art are interwoven, interdependent. We live, and in order to be able to live, we tell stories about ourselves. This is how we communicate. And we write again in order to rejoin the world in a fresh way. And that is also why we read. Primo Levi, the Italian writer, when he was freed, liberated from the concentration camps, he said, "I write in order to rejoin the community of mankind." And that is why we write and read. And so when I came to America, I realized that I cannot constantly separate the way I live from the way I write or from the way I read. And I wanted to communicate this to the people in the country that had so generously accepted me, that how life changes the way we read and write, and how what we read and write changes the way we live, and to show them these intersections between what we call fiction and what we call reality. So I sort of had to invent this way of writing in order to communicate that.
And it's a wonderful genre. I hope that many people read the book because it makes you think about it. I mean, I remember being in high school and having occasionally a very intense English class where we learned something or felt something, or I felt something in a way I'd never felt it before. And then you go back into the hallway and everybody's just as mean as they were before. And and you start to wonder, like, how do you integrate this, and when does it ever get integrated, or if it does?
No, you're absolutely right. And I became so preoccupied with this idea once I had written in my diary sort of an outline for a book about the places where I read books. Because, you know, books, both as carriers of ideas and imagination, taking us to all these different worlds, also as objects become very important to us. I'm sitting here in my living room looking at the books on the shelves, and each time I pick up a book and I touch it, each book feels differently and brings back to me the memories of places and people I have lived. And you are right that we are all, you know, when we talk about books, immediately I think strangers become intimate strangers. Immediately I feel a bond with you. But back in the hallway, you know, we all go back to our you know, usual selves. So in a sense, communication through books brings out the best in us. And even if for a moment it makes you feel at one with the world that can be so cruel and so indifferent. And right now, in the kind of world where we live, where our children, even the games they play, is about someone killing someone else, the news we watch is about people beheading one another, and then we watch people on the news, each channel, beheading the others through, you know, each ideologue, using words in a violent way. I think that reading these stories will help you regain a certain inner balance and a certain love for the world, despite its cruelties.
One of the themes in your book, The Republic of Imagination, is the process of becoming American. And you said something like, you know, you're truly part of your new country. It goes from being a foreign land to being your land when you start to grumble about it and try to improve it. And I wondered how that happened for you. What did you find yourself wanting to make better?
Well, yeah, that was a very strange process. And I always think that if, you know, I had left the country of my birth and everything that I loved behind, and I was coming to this country, and the sacrifices and the anguish I underwent in order to leave Iran had to make it worthwhile living in my new country. And in this new country, I had chosen it. So I had to make sure that I knew what kind of American I wanted to be. I always felt that, I always feel actually now, that if you don't define what kind of a country you want to live in, what kind of a citizen you want to be, somebody else is going to do it for you. And I realized how strange this process was, because I came to America because of all the freedoms I could not have at this point in Iran. But once I was here, and after enjoying these freedoms, I started thinking, well, I hate this system of education. I don't like the fact that our Supreme Court is talking about corporations being people and having the right to, you know, spend millions of dollars in choosing the candidates. I don't like the way our schools are no more teaching civic duties to our children. And you know, all these questions kept coming up. And I feel that if you love a place, you want to constantly make it better. To be a true patriot, it doesn't mean that you should say, hurrah, hurrah, I'm a great American, hooray for my country. No, it means that you worry about your country. And I like to be the kind of citizen that Mark Twain talked about when he said that patriotism means you support your country all of the time, but your government when it deserves it.
Right.
And you know, I want to be that kind of a citizen. And so I discovered that if I am so worried about so many things going wrong in this country, and if I'm really committed to change what I feel is wrong, then I better become an American. Or maybe I'm already an American and I don't know it. So that was when I decided that, you know, I want to be American.
We're talking to author Asar Nafisi about her book, The Republic of Imagination, America in Three Books. One of the fascinating paradoxes of the United States, which is evident in American literature, is that we are, on the one hand, an extremely materialistic country that measures success in material terms. We all know this. And yet our literature, as you point out, is full of vagabonds and adventurers and people who walk away from respectable society and who are anti-materialistic heroes. How do you understand this paradox, and how does it play out in our nation?
That is why I think literature is so important to us, because great literature, enduring literature, is one that while it reflects what the country or its people or its culture are about, is also it's sort of a distorted mirror that shows our flaws, that is also being subversive of the way we live. And that is what fascinated me about American literature, and you know, I'm bringing Huckleberry Finn as an example because most of your listeners would immediately know what I'm talking about. And Huck becomes the great American hero because of the fact that he is going in exactly the opposite direction that the society at his time was going. You notice that Mark Twain begins this deep and scathing criticism of conformity and complacency in different forms in American society. So Huck is running away from what he calls respectable society. He doesn't like to have wealth. He tells Tom Sawyer at the end of Tom Sawyer that wealth is not all that it is made out to be. He calls everywhere where there is civilization imposed on you and religion in the form of Sunday school, which is not religion that you choose with your heart and try to communicate with your God, but the kind of religion that is imposed on you, and the kind of houses he lives in. He calls them smothery houses. And he runs from the security, so-called, of those smothery houses with a runaway slave into wilderness. And Huck and Jim are most secure when they are together on that wild river on a raft rather than in those homes. And so I felt that American, great American fiction is the moral guardian of America, reminding us that this materialism can take you to a place that is stagnant and arid and complacent and dangerous. You notice that complacency and conformism in To Kill a Mockingbird or in Huckleberry Finn or in the novels I mentioned in my in this book, it can become very violent. And so I felt that this is where we go to experience what American morality and ethics should be all about.
And yet here we are in a country where the educational system is shifting once again, ever more standardized testing. And you quote the creator, David Coleman, of the Common Core educational standards, which don't even have fiction in them. They have like, what do they have, a quotation out of Shakespeare, but not the whole play, something like that?
Yeah, and also, for example, in one of the sort of instructions teaching to teachers how to teach it, they would have a passage from Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, but the instructions are that there should be no mention of memorials or funerals or the historical context. So you take a passage out of context and you create these questions whereby the students are just reacting to Gettysburg without bringing in the history, the emotions, and getting the students' own reactions to such an amazing event in the life of America itself. And so the whole point is that you need at certain points to have standardization, but you need to have in schools teachers that feel secure in their jobs, that are not underpaid and overworked, to have our children genuinely experience American history and American culture.
Yeah, and to bring themselves and bring their own lives and their experience to it. And the quotation that you put in the book by this Common Core guy, he said, he's talking about preparing students for the job market, and he says, "It is rare in a working environment that someone says, 'Johnson, I need a market analysis by Friday, but before that, I need a compelling account of your childhood.'" And that quote made me feel angry on so many levels. But I kept thinking about it, and I was like, well, okay, if the statement had been, "I need a market analysis by Friday, but before that, I want to know about your workout routine," it wouldn't be laughable in quite the same way, because everyone agrees that we should exercise, but not that we should be aware of ourselves. And then I was thinking, okay, let's say Johnson actually took some time to reflect on his childhood. He might reflect on the ways that he'd been part of somebody else's market analysis that seduced him into begging his parents for plastic junk that he didn't even need. And that kind of reflection, I mean, it feels to me like it's exactly what we do need so that the corporate system doesn't go crazy.
That is exactly the point. And it shows the kind of mentality that rules the Common Core, that he sees expression or literary expression as, talking about your childhood.
Right.
The whole point is that Johnson, even if you wanted Johnson to work better, you need to communicate with Johnson. You need to have somebody work in that place that is passionate about his work. So you don't tell Johnson, go to college in order to make more money or have a so-called vocation, as they keep telling us. But you tell Johnson, because you live in a democracy, Johnson, we, the society, are obligated to provide you with the best and most comprehensive kind of education so that you will find the kind of job that you love. so that you will give your whole being to it. But our schools, our universities, our hospitals, our public radio and even public television now have to take on the corporate model. You know, the corporate model is good for the corporate. And even the corporate have to learn something about what it means to be human, rather than making everything else act according to that model. And you know, you're right, I get so angry. I become so outraged. And the interesting thing about it is that you have people from both parties, both opposing and agreeing to this. Jeb Bush the other day was talking about, you know, how come, look at China. He was saying that the Chinese kids do not question the model. They just do what they're told. I just wanted to remind him that in China, they have now reached a dead end. They have been coming to our liberal arts colleges and trying to learn this model. They have reached the point where they understand that efficiency and just technology on its own will not be sufficient for our children to be inventive and innovative and find solutions to complex problems. And it's outrageous that we're doing this. You look at countries like China or like Iran or like Saudi Arabia, you will see that the contradiction in those countries and the paradox is that on one hand, the systems there, what they are afraid of the West is not the weapons. It is not technology. What they are afraid of the West is that culture of democracy, the culture that teaches citizens responsibility and teaches citizens to want their leaders to be responsible. That is why they constantly attack artists like Ai Weiwei or writers or journalists. That is why they attack minorities and women. That is why they think that the West is dangerous to them. And on the other hand, they all realize that without culture, without art, they can't survive. So all of a sudden, Qatar or Saudi Arabia wants to take the Louvre Museum or our universities to their places. You know, and how could we not understand that there can be no democracy without the freedom to think and to imagine? It just drives me crazy.
Yeah. And it goes back to that quotation that we read earlier, which is that how can you be loyal to your country if your country sees you only as an economic unit and not as a part of the soul of the larger fabric of the country?
And that is what we're teaching them, exactly. You are a unit who should be taking these tests in order to find a vocation. You're just a cog in this whole system. It reminds me of Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times, his silent film, where we are all cogs in the system. And then how can we ask citizens in this country, the new citizens who are being educated in this way, to go to war, to give up their livelihoods when the country is under recession or depression, when all we are teaching them is that you go to school, you live in order to make more money than your neighbor, than your colleague, and that is all that matters. And when multinational companies, you know, don't care about their environment, they just come into a city, take over it, and then leave it. When our leaders and the wealthiest people in this country don't care about America as a country, how could they expect us to care about, you know, to sacrifice our livelihood and our lives for them? You know, the old rubber barons, when you think of Carnegie or Mellon or Whitney, you see that they also had the sagacity to give their names to the great institutions of learning. The name library goes with Carnegie. When you think of our founders, Benjamin Franklin or Jefferson, devoting their times to creating libraries and universities, and believing that those who go into government service, like Jefferson, like Washington and Franklin, they believe that if you go into government service, you shouldn't get money for it. You shouldn't get paid for it, because money corrupts. And now money has taken over loyalty to friends, to country, to everything. None of us are going to give free service. It is mind-boggling how this mindset is taking over the country.
I wanted to change gears a little bit and ask you something else. Several times throughout the book, you refer to the character of Omar Little in The Wire, which I have to say is my favorite television program of all time. Do you think that TV and film do the job in this country of literature in some ways in helping us build that self-understanding that's necessary to democracy? Can film or TV at least sometimes take on that task?
Well, I think that some of these shows, and Wire, of course, is one of the best examples, are really helping us. And it is really amazing how people are driven. It is our elite who are not driven, apparently, to quality, because you notice how people are driven to quality shows. To shows that are not just preaching to them or are just amusing them, but shows like Wire that bring the reality to us, but also bring to us the truth behind the reality and at the same time entertain us. But what worries me is that each mode of imagining things or of articulating ideas helps us in a different way. That is why, since time immemorial, no form has replaced the other. I mean, you imagine that in the Greek era, Greek mythology or Greek plays, since then we have had so many modes of presentation, but theater is still alive. Or we have television, but film is still alive. And I think that the written word has its own place, that we cannot necessarily replace fiction with television shows. But what we should do is have both of them, because both of them are necessary to us. And they each do different things to develop us, both mind and spirit.
One thing I've noticed is that Iranian films are remarkably honest and emotionally profound, at least the ones that I've seen, while mainstream American films are often painfully shallow. I mean, they can do action, but that emotional depth is by and large missing most of the time. And I wonder what your thoughts are on the movies of your two countries.
You know, that is also another aspect of in Iran, a lot of films are doing what the films did during the Soviet era, because people have to live ordinary life itself, all the things that we take for granted and never think about, including the fact that every time you have to leave home as a woman, for example, you have to change who you are to something that someone else wants you to be. Otherwise, you can be flogged and jailed, and a lot of nasty things can happen to you. So even portrayal of ordinary life in a country like Iran takes on a great intensity, and film can do so much with images. In Iran, people go and see these quote-unquote very serious films the way people go to see, Kanye West perform, or when foreign films from long ago directors, like intellectual kind of directors like Antonioni or Ingmar Bergman is shown, people exactly act the same way as if they're going to watch Brad Pitt. So that intensity exists in those countries because their life is so deprived of life of ideas and imagination. And in America, that again worries me because everything is done technically well. But those limitations that made early American films so beautiful as well as entertaining is sort of a lot of times fading away. When I was in Iran, we were watching these old forbidden American films on forbidden videos, like we were watching films by Howard Hawks, the old Humphrey Bogart, Lauren Bacall films, or Marx Brothers, you know. And both my students, my children and I got such joy out of these films because there was substance to them, despite the fact America had this great merit that it could bring substance to popular music, popular literature, popular films. And now instead of substance, we have only appearance and entertainment. And I hope that the young people will rebel against that. Because now entertainment and high tech is not any more subversive, but establishment. Maybe the young will react against this sort of establishment, entertainment.
My guess is that our films will get better as our economy gets worse.
Yeah, it is a sad truth, but it seems that at times of economic hardship, maybe we need to reflect and to go inward and to try to discover what happened, what went wrong. But I also think that wise leadership, great education would be helpful at any time. When we went into the recession this time, I was comparing it to the Great Depression. And I was thinking, isn't it amazing, like during the Great Depression, when people were far more, dependent on government and for their just daily livelihood, and the economic situation was far worse, the government did not only not cut funding for arts and for writing, but in fact they created a Federal Writers Project, and they helped create new forms of expression. So through Federal Writers Project, we had a lot of great books written. We had Federal Arts Projects, which created great photography, oral history. All of this came out of that. And then we had someone like Eleanor Roosevelt, who after the war, they created the UN, human rights. This was the preoccupation of our elite. And just compare it with now. They are cutting the essentials, saying that they are non-essential. I mean, I always ask, did poets and teachers and librarians and musicians, were they responsible for the recession? And isn't teaching and being a librarian or an art historian also a vocation, that when you talk of vocation, you do not consider them? And when you talk about science, you know that great science research is also now being cut. We had scientists, we gave refuge to some of the greatest thinkers and scientists during World War II. And Einstein if you want to talk about science, you talk about Einstein, who was greatly in love with music, who believed that imagination is more limitless than science. Or at the beginning, when tech came into being, you had someone like Steve Jobs, who felt that imagination was at the center of what he invented. Now everybody is becoming empty of soul, and think that soul is harmful to our health.
Well, one of the things that you say in the introduction of the Republic of Imagination is that, in a way, these repressive regimes and democracies are distorted mirrors of each other, and they're both always in a state of change. No democracy don't always stay democracies. Repressive regimes don't always stay repressive. And when we get to the point where we ourselves are threatened by the arts and liberal education, it really makes you wonder what's the direction that we're going ourselves.
That is exactly it, because if our elite and our students just take a look at the country's history and history of the world, they discover that just past century, it's not even the centenary of fascism in Europe, and fascism came not out of Middle East, not out of China, it came out of the most civilized country in the world, namely Germany. And it came because people reached a state of chaos that nobody could resolve that chaos and fill the void that people felt in their lives with democratic ideas and thoughts. That is why we need our citizens to be educated about their rights and about their responsibilities towards their society and what they expect from their leaders. Why are the leaders responsible to them? Because if we don't think about it that way, we could lose a form of fascism or a form of repression in the most democratic societies. Just look at what happened to Europe. And of course, in our own country, in the United States, the history of the United States has been a constant history of fight for rights. I mean, 1960s and 70s are not that far away when people in this country, African Americans, could not go to the same restrooms as white people. This is very, very close history. And people have given their lives in order to change, in order to bring about a situation where we now are moving on towards fighting for more rights for minorities and for gays and for more rights for women and other matters. And we have to understand that freedom is not something God-given. Freedom is something that you're constantly fighting for, never completely achieving, and you have to be living in a society that is very aware of it. And I'm afraid freedom to be responsible and to hold others responsible is diminishing right now.
You are coming to speak on Friday, tomorrow, at St. John's College here in Santa Fe, and that's a place where imagination and contemplation of texts are not only allowed but required. Where else have you found in your travels that this spirit is alive and well in the U.S.?
This is one of the most amazing things. I mean, I'm really, really excited and intrigued to be coming to St. John. But one thing that is very intriguing to me is that over the past 10 years, since my first book was published here, I have been traveling at least 33 or 34 states, red and blue. And, you know, you go to bookstores, you go to libraries, you go to these small liberal arts colleges or state universities, and people come in droves. And nobody is dare to question the other person, whether they're Republican or Democrat or who they vote for. They come there because of their passion, because they want some meaning in life, and because meaning and passion cannot exist on their own. They have to be shared. They have to be shared in public spaces. And that is where I, find most joy. And that is why I feel I'm really lucky, because books are such amazing means of connecting us to one another. So I can, count countless bookstores and libraries where I have found a space that would remind me of a place like St. John.
Asar Nafisi, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It was such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Asar Nafisi is author of Reading Lolita in Tehran and the Republic of Imagination, America in Three Books. She will be at St. John's College tomorrow night, Friday the 17th of April at 7:30, at the Great Hall in the Peterson Student Center.